So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe. Frische Netzsekt, verschiedene Sorten, je 0,75 Liter Flasche nur 3,49 Euro. Und außerdem Emira Klettscheiben, Natur, je 200 Gramm Packung nur 2,22 Euro. Sichere dir außerdem bis zum 24. Dezember 10% Rewe Bonusguthaben auf Weihnachtssüßwaren. Nur in deiner Rewe-App. Frohe Weihnachten. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, Kat. We picked a good time to record because I think there's a house on fire down the street, so of course there's sirens going off everywhere.
Sounds lovely. I mean, our podcast is like a house on fire anyway, so there's not really much change, I gotta say.
Yeah, they're actually, maybe the sirens are for us. They're just getting ready.
Put it out. The Blood God is angry with this RPG podcast recording. We're recording a little bit earlier than usual because, I don't know, I'm doing a lot of traveling this week, Nadia. I'm thinking hard about buying Dragon's Dogma, actually.
That's actually not a bad idea if you're traveling. Dragon's Dogma is definitely on my like to buy list because it just seems like something I'd really like. I didn't get to play it the first time around, so I wouldn't mind giving it a try.
Yeah, I did play it the first time around, but it's been a long time at this point. Uh-huh. I played it way back in 2012 when it first came out on Xbox 360 and PS3. And wow. As I've said a time or two on this podcast, I remember everybody making fun of it and then being genuinely surprised and pleased at how good it actually was. And I'm looking forward to trying it out on the Nintendo Switch. By all accounts, it is an excellent port.
That's always good to hear. I think Mike actually phrased it to the stars, saying it was a really good port and like proof that we need more of those kind of rarer ports on the Switch, like from the last generation, especially for people like myself who missed out the first time around.
Is there a particular game that you could think of from last generation that you wish that you could see on the Nintendo Switch?
Oh, there's a whole bunch. Of course, there's a whole bunch for the Wii U that I wanted to see. Xenoblade Chronicles X, that game's anniversary just went by, apparently. And but that's
people
probably
are
going to
be upset. But I have literally no interest in seeing that ported over to the Switch. I don't think it's a very good game.
Well, it's not going to happen anyway. You probably remember I did the interview with the Xenoblade Chronicles team last year, and they said it's a lot of time, a lot of money, and Monolith Soft, frankly. You're right. I think they have better things to do right now. I think at least part of their team is working on Zelda, the new Zelda.
I can think of two games that I would like to see ported from last generation onto the Nintendo mm-hmm. Switch. One of them is Lost Odyssey, which is a game from the Xbox 360 developed by Mistwalker, so Hironobu Sakaguchi, which is basically a Final Fantasy IV classical 16-bit RPG from that generation, to the point where like some of the characters are kind of recognizable as being in that archetype.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I would actually like to see see a port of that.
Yeah, I think it's one of the kind of, I wouldn't exactly call it a lost treasure or lost gem, but it's significant enough that, and I don't think enough people played it because of the system that it came out on. Plus, there was a lot of disdain. A sad amount of disdain, frankly, for 16-bit RPGs at that time and Japanese games in general.
Yeah, there really was. It was kind of a dark period. That whole generation was a little bit dark for Japanese games.
It was dark in general, also gray and very bland.
And brown.
Yes.
And very brown. It's funny, though, Dragon's Dogma is an exception to that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that was when around the time that the Japanese games industry started to pull out of the tailspin a little bit. And
yeah,
Capcom got off to a really good start that generation and then dipped down and then dipped back up a bit. I remember, as I was already saying, everybody was making fun of Dragon's Dogma and had literally no expectations for it. So that's why it came. And of course, Japanese games were a little bit at their near dear. Dark Souls definitely helped things out a lot around that time. But Dragon's Dogma ended up being a nice surprise. The other one was the Persona/Fire Emblem spinoff for the Wii U.
Oh, yes. I think only Mike played that, and he was like had no expectations for it, as I recall. And then he comes to us and says, guys, this game is really good. And that's what every single person I know who has played the game has said. It is a really good game, severely overlooked, and it is just prime Switch material. And Nintendo's going, just it's not happening.
It was called Sharp FE. Or that's the only name I can remember right now. What was it called in America?
It was called Sharp FE. I think the word idol might have been in there, too.
Tokyo Mirage Sessions. That's the one.
Tokyo Mirage Session. That's the one, yes. That's another one. That was going to be my second pick. You know what? I really want to play that game, especially now that I know so much more about Persona and Shin Megami Tensei. I'd play that in 5 seconds.
You know, we're doing kicking off a new segment this week, Nadia. We're going to be talking about the individual legacies for every single console, pretty much. We're starting with the earliest ones, Coleco and Intellivision and Atari 2600. Not a lot of RPG legacy, but we'll be talking about them. And thinking about the Wii U, I see Wii U defenders still popping up from time to time. People insisting that the Wii U could have been saved. And sadly, the Wii U, while it had a few good games on it, it's kind of a black hole for games like Sharp FE. It just felt like they were doomed to die because the install base on that game was so low.
It really was. And that's actually something that's been going around lately, the question, did Nintendo abandon Wii U owners? And here's the thing, as a Wii U early adopter, like from day one, I bear no ill will whatsoever for Nintendo to just kind of ditch that and start over again and do it right with the Switch. It was just an awkward, the Wii U was really kind of almost an awkward prototype to the Switch.
If anything, Nintendo held on way too long because it kept giving it pretty solid first party support all the way until at least 2016. And that's just too long.
Yeah, and that was actually, Nintendo came out with some really good stuff. That was, you know, they're backed in a corner and they gave us Splatoon, for example. That was just a really good, interesting idea that did actually take advantage of the double screen. So, we had some good stuff out of that generation, but God knows I am happy to see most of it on the Switch, and I would like to see more of it on the Switch, please.
Yeah, the Switch has almost entirely co-opted the legacy of the Wii U to an even greater extent than the Nintendo Wii co-opted the legacy of the Nintendo GameCube. Because the GameCube still had a lot of remarkably great games on there. The Wii U was kind of flat from the very start. I mean, it's telling that one of its absolute best games was a port of Wind Waker, an updated port, no question about it. But yeah, it was grim for that system. And I don't want to keep piling on the Wii U, but I'm just reminded of like how many games I want to get off that thing and onto a console that people actually play.
Please say, you make it sound like a charity for like lost puppies. Please save the Wii U games.
I mean, that's what it is, right? Every time, thank God they got Bayonetta 2 off this thing. Oh, thank God they got new Super Mario Brothers U off this thing. Great. I can play it. People will play it now.
Yes, because I frankly have not, like, I usually go back to old consoles once in a while. I have not gone back to my Wii U ever since I got my Switch. There's just no reason to whatsoever.
Sadly, I don't think Tokyo Mirage Sessions will ever get ported to the Switch, because I haven't checked the sales numbers, but I can't imagine they're very high. And as a very weird spinoff that was done in conjunction with Nintendo, it seems like there are probably going to be special considerations, so unless Nintendo actually funds this thing to come over, which I can't really imagine why they would do that.
Yeah. I don't even think it did that well in Japan, which is like, you know, total territory for SMT and Fire
Emblem. It's so specialized as a game. It's a very specific taste. But who knows? I mean, so much is coming out on the Nintendo Switch these days that we never know. But I would love a remastered version of Lost Odyssey. I mean, for God's sake, they're doing a remastered version of 13. A game that nobody freaking asked for. You can at least do Lost Odyssey.
I agree, branded as
the Lost Classic by Final Fantasy creator Hironobu Sakaguchi. And
done, sold. Actually, Sakaguchi has a Mistwalker, I believe, has a mobile game that I've been a little bit curious about. Something about After Eden or Beyond Eden, something like that. But it's a mobile game, so a mobile RPG, which I have expressed reservations about before on the show, and I'm probably never going to play it. But there is a character who is just pretty much Frog from Chrono Trigger. They didn't even disguise it.
Sakaguchi working on a console game as well? I seem to recall that he explicitly said that he was doing something in conjunction with CyberConnect 2.
I think so. He's probably got a few irons in the fire by now.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of games that were planned for the 3DS just straight up got canceled. I've heard of at least a couple games that were slated to come out this year for the Nintendo 3DS that would have been of interest to RPG fans, but were ultimately canceled, which is a super bummer.
That is a bit of a bummer. Like, is it possible it might come out remastered for the Switch, whatever these games are?
I mean, we would have to guess, but I imagine that anybody who wanted to do that would have to submit a big plan explaining why exactly it would be worth putting this thing out on the Nintendo Switch, a game that is already flooded with software. So I already mentioned that we're going to be going through the initial legacy of the Atari 2600, ColecoVision, and Intellivision, and talking about the early days of RPGs in general as part of the kickoff for our new segment. Also talk a little bit about RPG news this week. We're recording extremely early. We're recording on a Monday, so we don't have as much RPG news to go over as usual. So this episode will be a week old by the time you listen to it, but I apologize for that. But in the name of the Blood God, I need to get this episode out every single week, so I'm going to make it happen. But if you enjoy the podcast, I recommend that you subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. We're also on Spotify. If you enjoy our podcast, please leave a review and subscribe to our newsletter, which comes out every Wednesday, gets you all of the RPG headlines, and includes some thought from one of the two of us, usually Nadia, because Nadia is the better writer out of all the two of us.
Shucks, I wouldn't say that.
Okay, so the main piece of news that I'm seeing for RPG related here on Monday, and this one, probably not surprising, Nadia, but I thought I would bring it up really quickly. Pokemon Sword and Shield is explicitly being developed with an emphasis on portability. Any thoughts on that?
I think reading the story is more or less what you predicted for this new generation of Pokemon, being that, yes, of course, they want new fans who came in with Let's Go Eevee and Let's Go Pikachu to get into this series with this game, of course. But they also want to let established fans know, hey, this is the Pokemon you probably remember best. This is more about portability and less about playing it with a friend on your TV screen. And I think maybe we got a hint of that when we both noticed in the trailer for Sword and Shield, they got rid of basically encounters that you could see on the overhead map. And we were both a little bit disappointed about that, but it's not too surprising.
Well, if I recall correctly, Pokemon Let's Go has a strong emphasis on motion controls and that sort of thing.
Yes, and that's going to be gone as far as I can tell.
Because it's supposed to be baby's first Pokemon, right? Say a cute game that you play with your three-year-old daughter, which is exactly what one of my good friends ended up doing. And they had a blast, I might add.
Yeah, of course.
It was their first introduction to Pokemon. She absolutely loved it. She's a maniac for Pokemon now.
The trap has been set.
She's going to watch the cartoons and all that jazz. She's going to get sucked into the Pokemon merchandising machine.
Merchandising.
But
the Poke Vortex.
This one is very much seemingly for the hardcore fans, and that means taking your Nintendo Switch to events and being able to trade and be able to play online and all of that stuff. I think I've said before that Pokemon doesn't need to be an MMORPG because MMORPGs as a concept is decidedly old-fashioned these days. Sorry, MMORPG fans. I know some of you...
You had a good run.
Yeah. I know that you guys are still playing... Plenty of people are still playing Final Fantasy XIV, for example.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the days of big-budget, large-scale MMORPGs are very steadily coming to an end. You have a few pillars remaining, World of Warcraft, Final Fantasy XIV, maybe a couple others, but the days when...
We're beyond the point where everyone was trying to ape that formula that World of Warcraft had, because every big developer at a time seemed to be wanting to do their own take on MMORPGs.
And I say, thank God, because screw MMORPGs, they're the worst genre of RPG, or the worst flavor of RPG, in my opinion.
I still want to play Final Fantasy XIV very badly.
But Pokemon is all... The genius of Pokemon is that it was a quote-unquote game as a service before games as a service were even a thing. Because it lets you carry over all of your progress and all of your Pokemon and all of that jazz to each subsequent generation. So everybody has a kind of... people who have been playing for a long time have a certain amount of investment in the series. Yes. They have their collections. They have a lot of memories that go into the creation of their Pokemon. Each subsequent entry is an entry point into that expanded universe of Pokemon. So you go through the extended tutorial, now you're in the universe, in the community and everything. It's why the Pokemon community is one of the absolute strongest in all of gaming. So it totally makes sense that they're just going back to where they were before.
Yeah, and I foresee that, and probably you foresee as well, that this rumored Switch that's smaller and lighter and more portable is probably going to come out around the same time and sell 50 billion copies and units.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons that they said we're putting more emphasis on portability, because the Switch Lite is built around portability.
Yes, which is like a really, really smart move, putting that out at the same time as Pokemon Sword and Shield. That's instant seller, the end.
Pokemon and Animal Crossing and Fire Emblem and Mario Maker 2.
Yes, which are all, except for maybe Mario Maker 2, but yeah, those are all very good games that are very compatible with portability.
Will you get a Switch Lite when it comes out?
I'm undecided. I really don't know what I'm going to do with the Switch, because... Of course, I love my Switch, but the Joy-Con issue is a little bit out of control, where I have the drift and I can't really fix it. I can temporarily fix it, but no permanent fix yet. So I'm definitely overdue for a new Switch, but I'm just kind of waiting to see what Nintendo is going to show us, because I'm hearing, okay, we're going to get a totally new model of the Switch that's more powerful. And I'm also hearing, oh, we're going to get a basically the same model of the Switch, just more powerful. And of course, I'm hearing Switch Portable, which I might, you know what, that's actually a very appealing option as well, because I play almost exclusively handheld.
There's no way that I'll buy a smaller system with a smaller screen. I like, if anything, I want to go bigger. Bigger!
That's understandable, especially since I don't travel a whole... I do travel quite a bit for work, but not like, you know, tons and tons and tons. I'm not like my brother, who travels like 1 week out of every month. In which case, I would want to take my Switch everywhere. And in that case, yes, I would get like a more portable Switch that I'm a little less paranoid about losing. But I can see where you're coming from, because, yes, I kind of like the size of the Switch's screen right now.
Yeah, I'm sure that we'll cover this at some point in the future. In the short term, one thing that I find pretty interesting, and I'm sure Nintendo is maybe aware of this, is... A lot of the hardcore Pokemon people that I know are really annoyed by Pokemon Let's Go, because they got basically no traffic from it.
Basically no no one's playing it the post game.
It didn't have any legs, and it had a almost entirely different audience than the traditional Pokemon audience, which I'm sure has Nintendo going woohoo, right? I mean, it did sell like 10 million copies. But those people did not stick around. They did not stick around and keep playing Pokemon Let's Go. They finished the game, and then they were out.
No, that's right, because I actually tried to write a piece about the post-game for Pokemon Let's Go, and everyone was like, "Eh, I don't know."
Everybody was like, the post-game sucks.
We're not playing the post-game. What do you want from us? It's like, oh. Well, they're very nice about it, but like, yeah. No, it was very much a game. Like, I loved it. I really had a good time with it, but it is very much the kind of game.
Cute.
It is very, very cute, but... You know, I basically beat the Arcanine Master, and like I got my title, and that was all for the post game for me. That was all I needed to do.
Just gotta beat the Arcanine Master. Who
and
cares?
It's, yeah,
it's all about you and the Arcanine.
Pretty much
the big fluffy puppy.
He's very cute.
Big fluffy.
I can't wait to see him in the movie.
Before we move on to our main segment, Nadia, I hear that you've started playing Trails of Cold Steel.
Yes, I have. I haven't gotten too far. But I have started playing, and it's a very, have you played it at all? I can't remember.
I have played it, yes.
Yeah, it's very, very much a Falcom RPG in that you have that, like, the same kind of character models, You have like the same kind of music. And none of this is an insult at all, because as we have established in the past, Falcom knows their RPGs. They're good, solid games. They're like not going to blow the top off your head or anything like that, but you're going to really enjoy yourself. You're going to like the characters. You're going to like the music. You're going to like the graphics. So far, I actually really like the battle system for this game, which is kind of a... It is a menu-based RPG, but it has a big emphasis on area of effect attacks. So where you are in position to where your enemies are, it does matter quite a bit. And you can actually move around and adjust your strategy that way. But yeah, from what little I've played so far, yes, I like it quite a bit. And I actually didn't really realize how old the Trail, Legends of Heroes Trail series is. Like, it goes back to, like, God, the PC Engine, or even further back, like the...
A lot further, like all the way back to the original PC.
Yeah, and you know what? You got to hand it to Falcom. They've been at it for a very, very long time. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, they sure do. They have such deep roots in the RPG space that we could probably do an entire podcast just around them. Of course, that's like more Retronauts territory, but they do have an extremely rich RPG legacy for sure. As for Trails of Cold Steel, you know, there's a little bit of repetition going on in there. I don't know if you've managed to get to the one dungeon, like one of the first dungeons you have to do multiple times, if I recall correctly.
I haven't done that yet, but that sounds like a very RPG thing to make
me do. Sounds like a very Falcom thing to do. But the class is a fun bunch of anime archetypes, and there's a little bit of a Valkyria Chronicles flavor to the way that the politics and everything unfold.
Yeah, I did get very much a Valkyria Chronicles vibe from not just the military academy, but we're at a military academy and there's a war going on, and we're all very prestigious and stuff.
Yeah, it has a great battle system too.
Yeah, I really do like the battle system quite a bit. I really like the fact how you can sneak up behind an enemy, and actually the way that you, it's not just a matter of, oh, you sneak up on an enemy or you don't. The way you sneak up on an enemy determines what kind of an advantage you will get. And you can get, like, if you have, like, a really good score, you can score up to, like, triple benefits, like, you know, just crazy amount of buffs and debuffs, and you hit first, and it's just really a really interesting RPG so far.
All right, well, I'm not quite ready to plant my flag and declare a Legends of Heroes Trails of Cold Steel report yet, but I do think that we should check in periodically to see how you're doing.
Oh yeah, definitely. And just because I kind of been in the mood because of this game, I've gone back on the Switch to play a little bit of Ease 8 again.
Oh really? How are you enjoying that one?
It, like I said, it's hilarious to look at the parallels between them, even though, of course, Ease is a very different game. That's a much more action RPG, whereas Trails is a more menu-based RPG. So it is kind of interesting to see the Falcom archetype, except it with two different systems. That is interesting.
Well, everybody knows that when it comes to, I mean, every studio has its own house style, right? I mean, you can generally tell a Square Enix game from a Falcom game, from an Atlas game, for example.
Yeah, except, I don't know, it seems a little stronger with Falcom. And again, I'm not criticizing, it's just, I think it's actually a really kind of endearing trait. And they're a smaller studio that kind of does one thing and does it really well, so I don't hold it against them.
Yeah, I interviewed their president, I think 2 years ago now, it was back in 2017. And it was enjoyable to hear his story of how he was a game developer who just really, really enjoyed Falcom's games, and now he gets to run the whole company.
Can you imagine, like, being a fan? Like, wow, I really like your games. Oh, you're in charge now. Bye. Yeah, we're taking off.
Exactly. All right, so we are going to move on to our new segment, which is the RPG Console Quest, in which we go through every single console and talk about its RPG legacy and pick the best RPG. So let's get going. So my original impetus for creating this was that I wanted this to be the topic of episode 200 of Axe of the Blood God, Nadia, if you'll recall correctly.
Right.
And yes, I do. My idea was, okay, we'll pick the best RPG on every console. Sounds great, right? And then I took a step back and I was like, man, that's a really big discussion. That's way too big for a single podcast.
Yeah, and we're already pretty bad at like overestimating or underestimating how long certain topics will take.
Yeah,
to talk
and
about.
I was like, I don't want to make this a 5-hour podcast, but I didn't want to give it short shrift. So I thought, well, what if we turn this into a segment? And here we are, the RPG Console Quest, which is our quest to go through every single console from the Atari 2600 to the frickin' NES to the Sega Genesis to the Sega Saturn. All the way up to the PS4 and the Nintendo Switch and the Vita. Don't forget the Vita.
No, can't forget the Vita. Vita means life.
And this is a long-term project. And this should carry us for at least a little while longer and give us enough content that maybe we can get up to episode 300 someday.
Someday.
We're on episode 204 and I'm already so tired, Nadia. So, so very tired.
Well, we keep on plugging on.
Keep on plugging on. So, so we are starting with the Intellivision and the ColecoVision and the Atari 2600. And I'm curious, Nadia, what are your memories of these early, early consoles? So, we're about the same age.
We are.
Which is to say that we were a little young for the first generation or second generation, I guess, technically, of consoles, right? Because, I mean, my first memory was of playing an NES pretty much.
Oh, I actually, I do remember them quite well because I didn't have an Intellivision, but my neighbor did, but I never got to play it because she had it in the closet somewhere and God only knows, you know, where the hookups were. But I did have a ColecoVision and I did have an Atari 2600 attachment for it. And the ColecoVision with Donkey Kong was my first game and my first console.
That's right, because you could buy an attachment that would let you play Atari 2600 games on ColecoVision.
You could. It was like a real wild west of rights back then. It's impossible to even think back now and think about how Activision was like formed because this like kind of spunky gang of third-party developers wanted to stick it to Atari and say, hey, you can't tell us not to develop for your system. We're going to do what we want.
So it shouldn't be that weird because we have, I don't know, Blu-ray players in which you can stick any kind of Blu-ray into them, right? I mean...
Yeah, no, you're right. Just thinking in terms of what Nintendo did later when it came around and like just the lockouts and the licensing and everything like that from that angle, when I looked back on it as a kid, it's like, wow, things were a little bit wilder back then, weren't they?
Well, I mean, it was the primordial ooze, the formative moments of video game history where everybody was just kind of figuring things out. Like nobody even knew how to run the business back then. They just knew that people wanted these kinds of games, right?
Well, for the most part, we were also talking about a time when they would give us like Purina Chase the Chuck Wagon. And there was some sort of like Crest game, like Dental Attack or Plaque Attack. That was it. And the Kool-Aid Man game. And you had to pay for this.
Oh, yeah.
It's like...
Yo, Noid.
At some point, someone realized, hey, we can pay people to play our advertisements.
God. Like $50. $50 to buy their stupid pizza game stupid game starring a pizza game mascot.
Here's the thing about, like, growing up in Canada, I didn't know what the hell the Noid was. Like, for some reason...
I barely did either, because he was from the 80s, I think.
Yeah, and he just, like, was not much of a... Like, first of all, Domino's didn't really have much of a presence here for a long time, and then I was like, what the hell's a Noid? Like, my husband still wears a shirt that says Avoid the Noid, and everyone's like, what the hell's a Noid? When they see him in it.
Or when 7-Up turned its damn spot into a mascot.
Cool spot, yeah.
And they made a video game about it.
I think they made a video game out of him and probably Fido Dido.
But I did actually have an Atari 5200.
How the hell did you end up with a 5200?
So my dad actually did play video games.
Oh.
He was always kind of a tech nerd, and he got into IT at a very early age. And so I always had computers and things around the house, and my dad enjoyed going to arcades in the 70s and early 80s. And he bought an Atari 5200, which came around the time of the great video game collapse. And so we had an Atari 5200 just kind of floating around the house, gathering dust. Though I did play a lot of Star Raiders on it.
Yeah, that's a good choice. Like, if you're going to play anything on the 5200, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. So, of course, I mean, while I did play games on the Atari 5200, and I think my friend had an Intellivision. I could be wrong.
It's one of those, the Intellivision is one of those systems where you always knew someone with it, but, like, you never had one yourself.
Yeah. I didn't know the difference between them. I only knew NES at the time, but I had an Atari 5200.
Uh-huh.
But of course, ultimately, I was more of an NES kid, as were, you know, pretty much everybody our age.
Yeah, I mean, me too. Like, even though I had a ColecoVision, which was actually a good system, and I had an Atari 2600, which was it was a thing. It was like it wasn't until the NES I realized, wow, this is what video games can be. I really wasn't that into the sort of arcade, cheap looking arcade clones that the 2600 was capable of.
I can appreciate now. So I did not appreciate this back then.
Mm-hmm.
I remember everybody was like, wow, when I first saw an NES, I couldn't believe how good the graphics were on that thing. And yes. At the time I was like, what are you even talking about? The NES looks so dated, because I was thinking in terms of arcades, right?
Right.
Like, even in the late 80s, I'd go into arcades and I could see the difference in graphics and how much better than they were than the NES at that time. But now when I look at how much better NES games look than, say, an Atari 2600 or ColecoVision game, whoo, we've come a long way even then.
Yeah, like, I did not hang out in arcades at all when I was a kid. And, like, you know, if I was out shopping, I'd want to look at, like, the arcade games. It's like, my mom would be like, no, let's go, we're going home. Like, I never really got a chance to really get into them.
Yeah, I just remember that. So I was watching a lot of videos today for old Atari 2600 games. Uh-huh. And I was thinking about them in comparison to the original Super Mario Brothers, and even Super Mario Brothers, which today, by today's standards, is so primitive. Like, that game looks amazing compared to what you could have gotten on the Atari 2600.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the best looking and probably the best Atari 2600 game, period, I could recommend is Solaris, which came out, like, quite late in the Atari 2600's life. And even that looks like nothing compared to Super Mario Brothers.
Okay, so let's talk about the earliest days of consoles. So you might be surprised to hear this, Nadia. There weren't too many RPGs, because most of the focus was on shoot 'em up sports games, other very simple concepts.
Yeah.
I mean, the very idea of RPG was kind of invented in 1974, was Dungeons and Dragons. And yeah, like, it had its roots in wargaming and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the notion of using stat calculation to decide your actions was an extremely new notion by the standards of the late 70s, unless you were heavily into wargaming. So, I mean, to put that onto extremely primitive consoles, which weren't even really capable of stat calculation, maybe a bridge too far.
It didn't happen very often at all.
No, exactly. And, I mean, if you want to, like, talk about how limited systems were back then, just consider that we didn't get our first football game that supported 11 players on the field until Madden in 1989. And even then, that was considered a big leap. Like, Madden was like, I won't make a video game, I won't make a football simulator unless it has all 11 people on the field. And EA was like, well, we'll give it our best shot. And then they put them on the field, and the game ran like crap. In 1989.
Was this for the... Would they try this on the Genesis?
No, this was on the original PC.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So it didn't come out on console until, like, 1992. So try to imagine... So now imagine, go back a solid decade or so and imagine trying to calculate complex statistics and that kind of thing on a very simple console like the Atari 2600, which is really kind of only good for something like Pong or you know, Pitfall. River Raid, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was actually like, you're usually talking about single screen games, maybe some simple scrolling like you have with Pitfall. River Raid's a little bit interesting because that actually uses an algorithm that has randomly generated levels, and that was actually quite an accomplishment for the Atari 2600 back in the day.
Yes, one of the earliest pioneers for women in the video games industry.
Yes, indeed. She was on the, I think, the Video Game Awards ceremony at one point. The video game.
Yes, I think she got a Lifetime Achievement Award.
She did, yes. And I was really happy to see her get that.
It was pretty rad. So you might be surprised, Nadia, to learn that there's heavy crossover between D&D players, Tolkien fans, and gamers.
Yeah, that is like the least surprising thing anyone has said to me here so far.
So the kind of people who are given to reading Lord of the Rings and playing Dungeons and Dragons are also the kind of people who were given to getting into game development. And perhaps you wouldn't be surprised to learn that people were very keen to translate the experience they were having in Dungeons & Dragons mm-hmm. and the stories that they were creating and telling in those early games into the video game space. So we've talked about this on past episodes, especially with roguelites. You saw early RPGs starting to pop up on university mainframes. Games mm-hmm. like based on Colossal Cave Adventure were being adapted onto these different platforms. Games like Wizardry, Ultima, etc. were appearing on the PC because the PC at the very dawn, the very earliest days of the PC was much more powerful than when you had with a home console that you could plug into your TV and much more open-ended. So,
yeah, it was a lot more, of course, you could upgrade it. You could, it just had more power to begin with. Of course, it was capable of much more in terms of calculations.
And this was when games like Akalabeth and Wizardry and such were starting to appear on PC, when Richard Garriott and some of the earliest RPG pioneers were doing their thing. We have a series called The History of RPGs over on the site that Jeremy Parrish has been writing on. Mm-hmm. And I suggest you go check it out because he has there's a lot of interesting insights into the earliest days of RPGs. So Dragon Quest is considered the first true console game, but I mean, there were some forerunners. One of the earliest examples is Adventure, which is a game that you've actually played, Nadia.
I have indeed played Adventure. It is more of an action RPG. A lot of people consider it the precursor to The Legend of Zelda because you're a little square and you pick up a sword and you kind of, I guess, carry the sword out in front of you like a poker. And whatever runs into your sword dies. And that includes, I think there are four dragons in the game. And they're actually, each one is programmed with its own sort of intelligence and behavior. Like, I know there's one dragon that's, you know, the red one is bold and will come right at you. The yellow one is a little bit shy and will hang back. The goal of the game, I think, is to basically, as you would assume for a game from that era, is very simple. Like, find the treasure, find the keys to the castle. It's very easy to get lost. Everything kind of looks the same, although there are differently colored areas, so at least you can kind of keep track of where you're going. You can move bridges around, like literally just pick them up and move them around, and I'm still wondering how that's possible. But it's very important as the kind of the precursor for action adventure RPGs, and also one of the first games to have an Easter egg, because Atari didn't let their programmers put their names in their games. So this, I can't remember the name of the programmer, that goes to show how much game history I know. He just kind of hid his name inside the game and you can find it there.
Because they wouldn't let you put the credits in. So that was the only way they could get credits, because games are great.
You gotta act like it's some sort of like underground, like secret. This is my name. Don't tell anyone.
A person made this. A person was behind this thing that you are playing right now.
I was a man.
I was a person. But I can't remember if this was the case with Adventure. My recollection, though, is that one of the creators of Rogue played Adventure and felt like they had solved it. And so ultimately decided that they wanted to make a game that was completely randomized and went and made Rogue. I think that was the case with Adventure. It might have been a different game, but that was the one that springs immediately to mind. Though it seems that there are some randomized elements in Adventure.
It's very possible. I'm not 100% sure.
I think the items are put in different areas.
Oh, okay. That makes a lot of sense. There is, like I said, some Atari games have like minor randomization elements. But given how early Adventure was and how influential it would have been to like people who wanted good accessible RPGs on consoles back then, I could see, like, you know, the creator of like Rogue going to it and saying, hey, I like this idea, I bet it can make it even better.
So there was actually a quote-unquote true RPG for the Atari 2600, believe it or not, and it's a game I've never heard before, but it's called Dragon Stomper, and it was released in 1982. It was written by Stephen Landrum. And it has stats, Nadia. It's not just an action game that's kind of set in a dungeon area. You have a strength. Which represents hit points, and dexterity for your armor class. There's no experience points or character levels, but there are theoretically stats.
Yeah, I had to look up this game because I had no idea it existed. Like, my knowledge of, like, RPGs on Atari was just like, oh, okay, there was adventure. But no, there's actually quite a bit more than that. And, yeah.
Quite Dragon a bit Stomper, more equaling one other game.
But Dragon Stomper was worth a lot because, and this is what interested me, it was for a peripheral that was a tape player that you could plug into your Atari 2600. And it wasn't like, oh, okay, here's the, you know, here's the thing that you plug into the Atari 2600 and then you plug your tape into it. No, what you would do was you take your little thing that plugged into the Atari cartridge slot, and then you hook up your own Walkman to this module through the headphone jack, and you play these specialized cassette games through them. And one of those games, there's only like 15 of them, but one of them was Dragon Stomper. And as you said, it was actually a really big game for the Atari because I think Atari games, generally, you're looking at 128 bytes of memory, and a cassette game for this peripheral could be like up to like 6K. Ooh. And that made like a big difference. And if you look at Dragon Stomper, you will see actually that it moves quite fluidly for an Atari game. It has those stats we talked about. It has pretty good monster sprites. Like, the dragon looks pretty good for an Atari game. You have, like, you know, different kinds of monsters. You have guards, you have spiders, you have bugs. Yeah, it wasn't exactly a fancy-looking game. Your character was still a dash, like, literally a dash. But for what it was, just knowing that there was this whole peripheral that I missed out on for the Atari 2600, I was just like, wow, because I associate cassettes with computers, not the Atari 2600.
Yeah, you could call it the earliest iteration of, say, Dragon Warrior, where it's kind of a top-down game. You're wandering across an enchanted countryside. There are random encounters. It's turn-based. You get golden items, that kind of thing. Yeah, it mostly looks like a series of blobs on a screen.
It does a bit, yeah. And when you're attacked, it says, oh no, a spider.
Oh no, a maniac! Exclamation. Oh, yes. But there's a village and there are shops, like the trade shop, the magic shop, the hospital. Yeah. You can hire warriors to help you fight a dragon. Yeah. And then there's the dragon's cave.
Yeah, it has like traps and like, you know, arrows, the arrow traps and pits and stuff.
And relatively speaking, the dragon is really big. I mean, granted, you're just a dash, but it's a big dragon.
It's a big dragon, and it looks like a dragon. Adventurous dragons are kind of infamous for looking like ducks.
You know what plays once you win?
Oh, I think I heard that. Was that Britannia I heard?
Rural Britannia, yeah.
Yeah, they kind of use some like public domain there.
Well, it sounds like a very complicated game for its time. For a game that came out in 1982 on Atari 2600.
It really does. It strikes me as a game that's a lot more suited for the like what you'd see on the PC.
I remember when I was in high school and I started to learn very basic programming, literally basic. And my first thought was, I want to make a game. And I want to make a really complicated text adventure.
Of course you do, yeah.
Where your decisions matter. I think everybody just wants to push the limits of whatever medium they happen to have access to. Uh-huh. And we're now finally getting to a point where the medium is so big that it's actually kind of hard to push against the boundaries of it. But when everything was so limited in 1982, it's not surprising to me that there was some enterprising programmer out there who was like, no, I'm going to try and translate a very full Dungeons & Dragons experience onto an extremely simple console like the Atari 2600, a system that has virtually no memory whatsoever.
Yeah, and whoever did it had to use that peripheral for it, but still shows the ambition was certainly there.
So getting back really quickly to the cassette thing, I got to say that having a Walkman plug into this thing is the most 80s thing I've ever heard, and it's called the StarPass Supercharger. I like that's completely it. Love that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I actually had a Walkman in the 80s, and that was like a really big deal purchase back then. But so I just love seeing it like come into play in this way, like just that weird melding of music and data.
It reminds me of the Nintendo Disk Drive, back when Nintendo was still extremely self-conscious about the fact that they were creating a console. And so they were like, no, actually, it's a PC that you plug into your TV. See, there's a keyboard and a disk drive and a key and something to play music on. No, it's
you can learn music.
You can plug it into a modem and have download your stocks onto it. It's not a video game console. Psh.
Well, it's just like, it's funny because they had hesitation in the U.S. market, of course, but I guess they also had it in the Japanese market because the Famicom seemed to be family computer. It was much more computer like than it was like just a simple child's toy because you could learn BASIC on it. You could check not just your stocks but horse race scores, whatever they call horse race scores. I don't know.
There was also a game for the Atari 2600 called Crypt of Chaos, and this game is extremely obscure, but it is a first-person game that actually looks a fair amount like Wizardry, and I'm not entirely sure what it's all about. I was able to find its instruction manuals and everything, but it sounds a little like a roguelike. Your objective, according to the instruction manual, your objective is to descend as far into the crypts as possible, stealing every treasure and killing every monster you can get your hands on. You must try to keep your kit count high enough to escape the crypts alive. And there are a series of complicated mazes. In order not to be discouraged, please read the instruction manual carefully and draw maps of the crypts as you reach and travel them.
Yeah, that sounds like the 80s, all right. I like how they decide your class for you. You're a thief. What if I want to be a warrior? Thief.
You're a Tomb Raider.
You're a Tomb Raider. You're
more of a Tomb Raider than a Lara Croft, apparently. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Crypt Raider.
Crypt Raider. The back of the box is so wonderfully early 80s Dungeons & Dragons. For centuries, the legend of the Crypts of Chaos has been cloaked in mystery. It is said that the crypts are guarded by gruesome and deadly creatures. Although many have entered the creepy crypts in search of ancient treasure, none have ever returned. And then there's a screenshot that actually looks really good for an Atari 2600 game of a maze and what looks like a little skull.
Oh, beware the skull. That is actually quite bold, because with Atari 2600 games, if you did get screenshots, they were kind of embellished, you know, a little bit touched up just a little bit to make them look a little more impressive than they actually were.
It's a 20th Century Fox game, by the way.
Oh, is it really?
Yep. And the games that you fight, or the enemies that you fight, are troll, frog, snake, skull, blob, eye, wizard, and dragon. And they all look vaguely like what they're supposed to.
Vaguely. That's all you can ask for on the Atari 2600. I like the names. Eye, blob.
Skull. Some of the monsters are harder to slay than others and require several attacks from your weapons, and the color indicates its strength. So it begins with green and then continues with violet, bronze, light blue, red, dark blue, lavender, and gold, which I think they're just making stuff up.
Yeah, that's okay. I am 100% like, okay, I understand how palette swaps work, but we're talking about, like, you know, green dragon and then red dragon, not like all the colors of the rainbow.
So each floor of the Crypts of Chaos is guarded by a monster. Trolls guard the top floor. Trolls and frogs guard the second floor. Trolls, frogs, and snakes guard the third floor. Man, this is like a really miserable crypt, just stepping through all of these damn trolls and frogs and snakes.
It sounds like one of those songs you sing as a kid, like the hole in the ground, like it kind of builds up and up and up and up. Like, here's the orcs, here's the orcs and the snakes, here's the orcs and the snakes and the trolls, and it just goes on and on and on.
So apparently there's difficulty levels. So you can go all the way up to expert gameplay, where you begin on floor 13 with 90 hits, 31 wand charges, and 7 ring charges. And remember to take all the treasure from all 8 layers in each level to get bonus charges for your ring and wand.
Wow, they actually did put a lot of thought into this game, didn't they?
Yeah. I have never heard of this game, and I'm sure this is literally the first time in God knows how many years that anybody's actually talked about this thing.
Yeah, because don't get me wrong, I wasn't exactly all up on the 2600 RPG scene or anything like that, but I've never heard of this. But it sounds pretty good. And you know what? It might be one of those, like Solaris, one of those really late releases that are super ambitious and actually pretty good for the Atari 2600, and then, you know, it kind of just got eaten alive by the NES anyway.
No. So competing consoles, there's ColecoVision and the Intellivision. So on the Intellivision, we had actual Dungeons & Dragons games, which I don't think were actually authorized by D&D. I think this was a period where people were just taking names, because there was at least one D&D game that was never released because D&D actually pushed back against it.
This must have been when they were under TSR, too.
Yeah this was back when it was still TSR. And not WotC.
Yeah. And then someone remembered what copyright is, and that was the end of that.
So the first one was Dungeons & Dragons. I think it was just called Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. And this one was basically a top-down game. You start with a map, of a vaguely fantasy-looking map. And then you are continuing through each particular area. You're trying to get to an end goal. And you are, when you go into a dungeon, you are basically a little blob with a club walking through an ill-defined hallway. And then sometimes a monster will pop up and start chasing you. It did not look very fun. I'm not going to lie, but a lot of...
I checked it out myself too. And it was like, yeah, this is certainly something I probably wouldn't have played.
But I guess it's just because it has the name Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, it seems to have had at least something of a legacy.
That makes sense. I could see it being one of those games where people think they're actually paying for a Dungeons & Dragons game and not necessarily getting it.
This was very much the heyday of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, I might add, because D&D came out in 1974. Mm-hmm. AD&D, I believe, came out in 1979 or thereabouts. And AD&D was the one that was really famous and pretty much everybody was playing. And so when you see something like Stranger Things, where they're all playing D&D, that's the version they're playing. Just basically, yeah. And then Second Edition came out in 1989, I want to say. So the game that maybe is a little more recognizable as a traditional RPG, and again, has a very wizardry kind of look, is a game called Treasure of Tarmin. And I got to say, if nothing else, it has some great box art.
Oh, I'm blanking what the box art looks like. I don't think I got to look that up.
It looks like your classical AD&D book cover. So you have a Grim Reaper at the top. You have a guy fighting a giant scorpion to the right.
Nice.
You have a castle with somebody kind of starting to enter it on the left. In the bottom left, you have a troll with an axe, and behind him is a whole lot of treasure. And there are some dragons flying behind the Grim Reaper, and it all has this wonderfully styled late 70s, early 80s look to it.
It really was a good time for, if nothing else, it was a great time for box art, for game box art.
Yeah, fantasy art was so good back then, wasn't it?
It really was. Like, it was really the heyday for fantasy art. And I'm not being like, get off my lawn or anything like that. I'm just saying facts.
It's like a late 80s manga, right?
Yeah.
I live for that style, because I think I've mentioned, I'm contractually obligated to mention every episode that I'm playing Super Robot Wars. One of the series in that game is a series called Aura Battler Dunbine. And if you want to talk about 80s fantasy mixed with 80s manga, there you go. Amazing.
I love that stuff.
It basically imagines, what if fantasy, like D&D fantasy, had mechs? Go.
That's pretty cool, actually.
It's great.
That's actually why I loved the Capcom Dungeons & Dragons arcade games, because you had that, like, that Dungeons & Dragons archetypes, but with, like, total manga 90s anime Darkstalkers sort of aesthetic. Like,
oh yeah,
here's race, like, super anime. It was amazing.
Yes, totally. But Treasures of Tarmin, also known as Minotaur and Advanced Dungeons and Dragons cartridge, it was 1982 was seemingly a good year for these games. Probably because it coincided roughly with when AD&D was all of the hotness and so big. Town sheriffs were literally showing up and being like, are you doing occult things?
I'm so glad I lived in a big city. Didn't really have that nonsense.
But yeah, Treasure of Tarmin was one of the very first RPGs that would have been recognizable by modern games for a console. Because as we already mentioned, it's the same year as Dragon Stomper. It had a faux first-person 3D gameplay with randomized dungeons, tons of weapons, items, and monsters, and It was a total technical marvel. And if you look at the screenshots, it looks incredible.
The Intellivision. Okay, yeah. Okay, now I'm picturing it.
Yeah, it's and noticeably better looking than anything on the Atari 2600. Like on the 2600, you had the little dash and some other thing.
Yeah.
This one has 3D looking mazes with like a skeleton that looks like a skeleton. It's really cool, actually.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And actually, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't the hero actually look kind of like someone clutching a sword?
Yes.
And not like a dash.
Not just a dash, no. But you're ultimately fighting, you guessed it, a Minotaur, because Minotaurs live in, you guessed it, labyrinths.
They tend to hang out there.
What is it with old-style RPGs, like the very first RPGs, what is it with them in labyrinths and mazes?
I guess they were so easy to program, and it's really a good way to get people to, obviously, if you can't have a lot of content in your games because you have, like, you know, 120 bytes to work with, just have them run a maze like a rat. That'll take up their time,
I suppose, because I think the whole point initially was, okay, you are a series of adventurers and you are going to fight monsters, and where do monsters live? They live in caves, and what are they guarding? Mm-hmm. Treasure. And so if you're playing a video game, you don't want to just walk into a cave, fight one monster and take a treasure. So it only makes sense that the cave be fairly complex and full of lots of different enemies that you can fight on the way to the big boss monster. And so that's how you end up with a fairly straightforward dungeon. And
yeah, pretty much.
And it's a very simple and easy gameplay concept to implement, to be like, okay, well, the further down you go, the monsters get more and more dangerous, etc.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even the more advanced RPGs, like we saw with Dragon Quest few years later, we were still wandering around in a lot of mazes in the dark, even though you had the overworld to explore.
Yeah, go check out our RPG podcast. It's like episode 100-something about dungeons, and where we talk about dungeons and the history of dungeons. It's fairly enjoyable. But I think that so much of it goes back to the Mines of Moria, which is the prototypical dungeon, mm-hmm. as it were, appearing in Lord of the Rings.
And that has the quote-unquote boss that has the Balrog, doesn't it?
Yes, no, exactly. And so, surprise, surprise, the Balrog got just lifted whole cloth and turned into one of the most famous roguelikes. So, yeah, Treasure of Tarman was, I'd say Treasure of Tarman might have been the best RPG you're going to probably get in that era. It was a big, complex, kind of gorgeously looking game with randomly generated levels, randomly generated loot, and lots of different types of enemies. And if you weren't just down with playing Pong all day long, or playing, you know, Pitfall, well, this was kind of the game to play, right?
Yeah. Even as a kid, I kind of appreciated more complicated games on my simpler systems. And, you know, even though I didn't have an Atari, didn't have an Intellivision, that does kind of strike me as the kind of game where I would be totally lost. I'd get totally destroyed every time I took a step, but I'd keep on trying because I just liked mazes and I liked monsters and stuff like that when I was a kid.
Well, it only made sense that arcade games were so big on these games, on these home consoles back then, because we were fully in the arcade boom in the late 70s, mm-hmm. early 80s, and the arcades wouldn't start to die for another few years after that. So, and everybody thought of video games in terms of high scores and that kind of thing. So
they did, yeah.
But it also made total sense that there would be people who would be like, no, I'm going to try and turn my favorite tabletop RPG experience into a video game. So, and with ColecoVision, there was supposed to be a game based on Tunnels and Trolls. And Tunnels and Trolls has an interesting history within the RPG space, because if I recall correctly, it was one of the very earliest versions of D&D. It was the second modern role-playing game ever published, and it was designed by Ken St. Andre and first published in 1975.
Huh. It's one of those names where I kind of think of it, but then I think like, oh, was that some sort of Dungeons and Dragons ripoff? And I'm guessing not.
So it continued to go on for quite a while, all the way into like the fifth edition and that kind of thing. So the reason I bring up Tunnels and Trolls is that it was actually in the process of being turned into an RPG for ColecoVision, but was never finished. All we ever had was a title screen. Right. So various homebrew groups have been trying to finish it.
We're bored by.
There's also a game called Gateway to Apsha, which was an early PC RPG. And on ColecoVision, they had a spinoff called Temple of Apshai. And it was a lot more action-oriented than Temple.
Yeah, okay. So this was like basically, I don't know if it was meant to be a prequel or a sequel, one or the other, but it was connected to Temple of Apshai. And it was a lot more action-oriented. An interesting thing about that game that I discovered today is, yes, there was a version on the Commodore 64. It had 18 levels, and those were procedurally generated. But on the ColecoVision, you had 99 levels, and those weren't procedurally generated. So that's a nice little trade-off there. I find that interesting.
I just like the idea that one is the gateway, so you just walk in the door and go, hello, to be continued.
You're going to die.
Next week, stepping into the temple. We got in the door. What will be waiting us for us elsewhere on the PC? Perhaps an actual RPG. I don't know. So yeah, that's a basic overview of the RPG space at that time. It was a lot of extremely simple dungeon crawlers that kind of were modeled after D&D. But out of this very simple kind of foundation, we started to see the outlines of RPGs that we know today. In a game like Dragon Stomper, we could kind of see the outlines of Dragon Quest. In a game like Crypts of Chaos or Treasure of Tarmin, we could totally see the outlines of wizardry. And that would eventually kind of form up and become the RPGs that we would eventually kind of come to love and everything. So, but it's impressive that they got RPGs at all onto these consoles, frankly.
Yeah, as you say, it kind of speaks to the determination of some of these people who are like, hey, let's take this machine that was not at all meant to make an RPG and make an RPG out of it.
Yep. So normally at this time, we would pick one of the best RPGs or the best RPG on those particular consoles. I don't know that we can really because, I mean, none of them is what we would call best. I mean, they're old.
Yeah.
They were pioneering.
They're kind of old. That's a very kind way to say it. They are pioneering, and some are very impressive for their time, but none of them are going to make the top 25 list of our RPGs anytime
soon. The sacred 25 RPG list.
The sacred 25. They're not invited. Yeah.
No, but they are interesting curiosities at the very least, and maybe useful for kind of understanding where we came from in terms of role-playing and kind of putting that whole era into context. In the meantime, though, there are people who are continuing to make RPGs for old consoles. In particular, Team Pixelboy has a whole bunch of party-based RPGs for ColecoVision, including Black Onyx, which is an actual party-based dungeon crawler, as well as Stone of Wisdom, which is a top-down Zelda-like dungeon crawler. And I think you said you actually knew Team Pixelboy.
I believe I am 99% sure I knew the titular Pixelboy.
The titular we're talking Pixelboy. About, like,
Titular Pixel Boy is talking about, I used to be part of a Mega Man chat group in 1995 on IRC. I was a total nerd. And I was friends with him. I talked to him all the time. And I haven't talked to him in many years. So if you're listening, Pixel Boy, hi. I don't know if you remember Rudd Draco, but hope you're doing well. Clearly you are. You're heading your own homebrew, and they're doing a whole bunch of really cool stuff for the ColecoVision.
I think it's really neat that there are people who love these particular consoles so much that they want to make these kinds of games. And I got to say that games like Black Onyx look really remarkably good, actually.
It's funny. This whole week, I'm discovering the length that people are going to make old software and old games for, to make software and games for really old platforms. Like, not that long ago, I reported about that port for Super Mario Brothers on the Commodore 64. Which doesn't sound like much, but for what the Commodore 64 is capable of, is actually a really, really impressive port and a really incredible feat of engineering what he did there. And of course, Nintendo just, you know, kind of said, forget that. But people still put a lot of effort and love into these games for these old systems, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that it gets back to what I was talking about earlier, where you can still push the boundaries of our video games today, but it costs an outrageous amount of money. And so you get into much more high concept kind of stuff. But
yes,
if you're a programmer and you want a serious challenge, then what better than to try and translate a fairly modern experience onto one of these ancient systems like the Commodore 64?
Oh, absolutely. Those are some really good limitations to work by. It's kind of like when I go back and write something for a magazine format and you have to say, okay, here's your, you have 500 words to tell me why I should buy this game. That's a big challenge for someone like myself who's been writing so long in the web format, but I really kind of enjoy that challenge. I like being told, okay, you have to cut yourself down and you still have to deliver something good.
So that was part one of our RPG console quest, in which we try and go through the legacies of every single console to date. And no, we're not doing the Magnavox Odyssey, for the love of God.
Or the Vectrex, sorry.
I don't think there are any RPGs on those.
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Let's talk about the RPG qualities of the Pong machines that got sold in the 70s.
But yeah, those were like, there were a lot of those.
Sure were. But yeah, no, so that was the very earliest days of RPGs on consoles. Next week, we're going to get into the Nintendo Entertainment System, which maybe has a little stronger of an RPG legacy.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Just a tiny bit. And we'll see which ones we continue to go through over time. I don't know that we're going to devote an entire episode, say, to the Atari Jaguar or some of these older other systems that have relatively limited libraries to begin with, let alone having actual RPGs. But
I think the consoles we talked about today probably had a better RPG history than the Jaguar.
I'm not actually sure. Well, we might be able to combine, say, the 32X and the Lynx and the Jaguar, because they were all kind of at the same time, right?
A sad episode.
Yeah, the saddest of sad episodes. But we got to do a little more research on that front. But in the meantime, I hope you liked the first segment. If you have any comments or you want to highlight any other RPGs we might have missed from this particularly interesting era, do me a favor and drop me a line at cat.bailey@usgamer.net or send me a DM. No, we're not going to do PC right out of the gate because PC is very much its own animal. The lines are a little blurrier, and I sort of feel like you can't do one episode on PC, right?
You really can't. It's a big, big animal.
I sort of feel like if you're going to do PC, you got to go by decade, right? So you start at the 70s and then you continue like 80s, 90s, 2000s. Like those are each defined periods of PC development. And frankly, I think that's an entirely different series.
I think so. Yeah, that would be a very, very involved series, frankly.
But I think the history of console RPGs is very interesting on its own. So we're going to.
I think so.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. So, all right. So let's continue on to the mailbag. Okay, Nadia, last week we talked about our favorite animal buddies in RPGs. And we talked about everybody from Boo the Space Hamster to Koromaru in Persona 3 to, of course, Dogmeat. Mm-hmm. And if you go onto the site right now, you can find Nadia's full write-up of that list on the site. But in the meantime, of course, everybody has their own opinions on this particular subject. And here are a few of them. Nimzy says, I'm going to throw in a vote for Final Fantasy Tactics' monster companions. Sure, they're mostly useless, but who didn't save Boko the Chocobo when they had the chance?
Yeah, that's fair. So I guess Boko showed up in Tactics as well as Final Fantasy V.
Yes, Chocobos totally did show up in Final Fantasy Tactics in general, and if you weren't careful and you were totally overleveled, they could kill the hell out of you.
Really? Like if you're overleveled or underleveled?
Yeah, no, overleveled, because the random monsters would match your level, if I would recall correctly. And you could find yourself in a situation where chocobos would just come in and annihilate you.
Wow, imagine dying to a chocobo. That would suck.
A whole pack of chocobos that just want to peck your eyes out.
Okay, well, you see, if I came in like face-to-face with a cassowary, like, yeah, I could see dying to one of those. So I guess dying to a chocobo is possible.
Dying to a cassowary. Speaking of chocobos, Que or Wark?
Yes, we had this discussion on Twitter, didn't we? I'm going with Wark.
Yes. Why?
Because it predates Que. I just
Que.
And nothing, you know the sound that a chocobo makes when it's pissed off, right? Like in Final Fantasy VII, like to me, that's the quintessential chocobo sound, the pissed off Wark chocobo.
Somebody on Twitter, Cena Breyer, said, "Quack is the standard noise. Wark is the equivalent of you stepping on a dog's tail and it going yipe."
That's actually quite suitable because, like I said, they seem to say wark when they're angry most of the time. But
I like that people have opinions on this, by the way.
It is an important topic. Although when you go to the Chocobo farm for the first time in Final Fantasy VII and, you know, you talk to Chocobo and it says wark, and if you answer wark in the correct form, they'll all dance for you, which is really cute. You get the summon material for that.
Caffeinated Brushes says, "The absolute worst animal buddy was Choo-Choo from Xenogears. You're telling me they didn't have enough resources to finish this promising game, but then they spent what little they didn't have on this horrible animal mascot? But at least Choo-Choo gets what's coming to her late in the game." Just look it up on YouTube. And I don't know if Ketchy counts, but I will never forgive him for kidnapping Marlene. That bastard.
Ketchy in Final Fantasy VII. Every time I play Final Fantasy VII, I try to figure out what the hell Square Enix was trying to do with that character. Like, he's a robot, but he's a stuffed animal. But I guess he's supposed to be wacky and fun, but he's actually piloted by a spy. Like, it's just kind of like, okay, is he a monster? Is he a toy? Is he a what? Like, he's a little too sophisticated for me. I don't trust him.
I think that with Ketchy, they just needed some kind of weird mascot to sell to Japanese audiences in particular. And so that's why you got Ketchy.
Oh, yeah, Red 13, if you want to, like, sell a mascot.
Yeah, I guess. But as for Choo-Choo, of course, Choo-Choo gets crucified.
Yeah, okay, I haven't played Xenogears, as you know. Were they playing that whole thing straight?
Yes.
Okay, so Choo-Choo really did die for our sins.
Well, all of the robots get crucified for some reason. And as Choo-Choo is technically a robot, because Choo-Choo just gets really big.
What?
Yeah, Choo-Choo grows to an enormous size to fight alongside the robots in Xenogears, which is, by the way, a very serious game about very serious topics.
I heard all about this, about how, like, Japanese audiences are much more serious and much more refined in terms of their philosophies than Westerners, but please go ahead.
But at a certain point, all the robots get crucified for some reason. I don't remember why. And Choo-Choo ends up being one of them.
Wow.
Yeah. Speaking of which, by the way, some people were throwing out various other creatures that have appeared in other RPGs. The Palicos from Monster Hunter is a good one.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a very good one, especially in World. My Palico was fantastic.
There was also Shiro from Suikoden 2 and the dog from A Bard's Tale.
I did mention Shiro. She was great.
And a lot of people mentioned Nall from the Lunar Games, which is this adorable little creature that kind of follows you around. I don't know too much about this thing, but it does look pretty cute in the pictures I've seen.
I think Nall is the... Lunar is one of those series I'd really love to have Silver Star Story on some sort of system that's not just physical medium. But Nall, I think, is actually a dragon.
Yes, a small dragon. Like a cat. Small, adorable dragon.
Looks like a kitty cat.
Yeah, put it on Switch.
Yeah, there you go. I'll play it.
Just put it all on Switch. I don't care. That's what I wanted.
Put everything on Switch. Declaration of Independence is on Switch now.
Ardea Abe says, "I'd like to make an honorable mention for Secret of Evermore Dog. He's the only other companion in your party, so Dog is with you the whole game. While the boy is constantly a fish out of water, the dog adapts. The dog is a hulking wolf in Prehistoria, a sleek, well-proportioned greyhound in Antiqua, a fancy pink poodle in Gothica, and a robot dog in Amiitopia. The dog is a great companion and is thoroughly a doggo. The dog starts your adventure by chasing a cat and chewing on some suspicious cables. The dog sniffs out useful alchemy ingredients for you. There are even some solo sections where you get to play as a dog during their misadventures."
Secret of Evermore is one of those games I want to like a lot more than I do, because it has a lot of really interesting ideas. And if you look back on them, you can kind of see where Western RPGs were getting their start on consoles. Might be worth a topic on its own someday. But yeah, the dog was part of your secondary party member, and he was pretty cool.
See, we've got so much more to cover in the RPG space, but as usual, we're running long on this particular episode, and we're going to have to cut it short, but we will be back next week, as always. But in the meantime, Axe of the Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at @_catpod. Nadia is @NadiaOxford. If you enjoy the podcast, make sure to review us. And if you have something to share with us, like a comment or a note, we may read it on the episode and talk about it and give you a little bit of a shout out. But we will be back next week to continue our quest through console RPGs, or maybe not. Maybe something will come up, but seems like we have a little bit of time before the next big RPG comes out. So this ought to fill in the space. We got like at least 20 parts to go. I haven't counted the number of consoles there are out there, but there's actually a lot. So I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to the Wonder Swan episode, Nadia.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting one. I know a lot of it ended up on the GBA eventually, but some of
an
it didn't.
Excuse to talk about Super Robot Wars and Gundam Seed. But
oh, I was thinking like Final Fantasy 4, but okay.
Look forward to that in like, I don't know, October or something. But in the meantime, I've been Cat Bailey, and for Nadia myself, thanks for listening. And until next time, happy adventuring.